MacCast, Sunday, February 11th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it is going to be a fun episode today. I don't know how long it's going to be. We don't have a ton of news to get into, but we do have a pretty exciting new product to talk about. Actually, I'm really excited about it. You'll probably hear that come out in this episode. But in this episode, we're going to cover a couple things. Are you going to get an Apple battery rebate? Maybe. Apple loses a TV producer over creative differences. We are going to look at iOS boot code that got leaked and talk about that. Just a ton of HomePod questions answered. Yes, the HomePod is here, and I'll have my opinions, and we'll try and answer a lot of your questions about what HomePod is, what it has, what it does, and why you may or may not want one. So we'll get into all of that, and then we have lots of follow-up to get back to on this episode, plus your feedback and a whole lot more. So I don't want to waste any time. I want to jump right in. We're going to kick it off with a little story about Apple Watch. Apple sold about 18 million Apple Watches in 2017. That's according to research estimates done by Canalys. And they say that's a record for Apple and a 50% increase over the 12 million they were estimated to have sold in 2016. And all these numbers are estimated because Apple doesn't actually give us real numbers. They don't report actual numbers on the total number of Apple Watches. They're just kind of lumped into a category. So we don't really know. But with these numbers, that means that Apple now sells more Apple Watches per year than the entire Swiss watch industry. I'm not really sure that means very much, but I thought it was an interesting fact and just something I wanted to share with you here at the top of the show. Apple is considering offering rebates to customers who replaced iPhone batteries prior to them implementing their new lower-cost $29 battery replacement program. So that means that if you had an iPhone that needed a battery replacement, iPhone 6 or later, and you've done that recently, Apple is considering that maybe they should give you some of your $79 back. The information came out as part of a letter sent by the Senate chairman of the Commerce Committee asking Apple to answer some questions about what was going on with those batteries. You know, if you've been listening to the MacCast or if you've just been following the Apple News in general, that Apple had done a little bit of software tweaking in iOS to prevent devices with older compromised batteries from crashing. And what they did was they tweaked the software so that in certain instances, the iPhone would run slower. And that caused quite a bit of controversy and many people were upset and Apple sort of had to answer and explain for that. And part of that answer was that, hey, we're going to lower battery prices, battery replacement prices to $29 over the next year. And I know you know a lot of this already, but some people may not. So that's what's been going on. And now they're saying, yeah, we are looking into, the senator asked, are you going to possibly offer rebates for people who had to pay for batteries at the higher rate? They said they're looking into it. We don't know when, if they are going to actually move forward with that, but it could happen. So we'll keep an eye on that. Somewhat related to batteries, another thing that Apple said they were going to do was put in a new power management feature and more information inside iOS. Well, the latest iOS 11.3 beta, I think beta 2 came out to developers, and there is a new battery health section in there. If you go into the settings, into battery, you can tap on battery health, and it will give you now a value for the maximum capacity of your battery. So it will show you how much of the charge you are getting versus what it was originally. So anywhere from 100% all the way on down. And it's considered that anything 80% or greater, your battery is still in good health. If it falls below 80%, that's when they're going to recommend that you actually replace it. And another thing that you'll find in this power management area is there is a setting for peak performance under that. So what it'll show you is if Apple is adjusting your peak performance to reduce crashes. And what they call that is you are in performance management. So all the language, I find it funny from a marketing perspective, all the language is very positive. They're not saying throttling. They're not saying throwing, you know, slowing down your phone. What they will say, if the battery has, it has detected that your battery is not running at peak performance, they are going to implement performance management on your iPhone. That's their fancy term for saying they're going to slow down the phone to avoid those crashes. But just also, as they promised, they will give you the option to disable that. There's a little disable link. They will warn you that if you disable it, you are going to run the risk of having your iPhone crash more frequently, but you can turn off the performance management to get full performance back if you'd like to do that, with the risk and the knowledge that your phone could get real crashy. So I have a feeling a lot of people aren't going to opt to enable it. Of course, there's also language in there that advises, hey, you might want to get in and get your battery replaced to take care of this and to bring your iPhone back to peak performance. So all that's in there, Apple making good on its promises. A couple other things of note that are in the iOS 11.3 beta, the latest one, there is a new version, or an updated version, I should say, of ARKit. That's Apple's augmented reality software. It's going to support better edge detection for irregular surfaces. So I guess for a lot of surfaces like round tables, it was having a little bit difficulty detecting the edges on that. So they've improved that. They've also added the ability to detect vertical planes. So it can do wall detection now. And there's developers already developing all kinds of interesting applications for, you know, putting virtual posters on walls or creating portals through walls for games and things like that. It's pretty neat. So that is coming in the next version of iOS, which I think is expected out probably sometime in the early spring. Another really cool new feature that's in there is something they added to the health application. They're adding support for health records. And in there, you're going to be able to, with participating healthcare providers and networks, potentially get access to your health records. So if you want to opt in for that, and that way you can share data and get data from your doctors. And I think we've talked about some of these features already on the MacCast, but since we were talking about iOS 11.3, I wanted to point out all the things that are in there in addition to the battery management stuff. And keeping on the topic of iOS 11 betas, tvOS 11.3 beta is out, and there's some interesting features in there. It adds the ability for the Apple TV to show up inside the Home app. So it's now something that's in there. You can't really do much with it other than kind of get details about it, but the Apple TV is in there. It adds support for AirPlay 2. Also, the new privacy icon is in there. I think we talked about that. Apple's adding a new privacy icon to iOS 11 that will pop up on, or show up on, a dialog to confirm that it's an official Apple dialog that might be asking for personal information like a password, and they will explain that to you. So that's happening there. And then the other big update is big part of the 11.3 beta update is they've added support for frame rate matching for the fourth generation Apple TV. So that was something that is in the Apple TV 4K along with support for HDR matching. Obviously, fourth gen Apple TVs don't do HDR, but they can do the frame rate thing. So that's where, depending upon, you can set it up so that if you have content that runs at a different frame rate other than, say, 30 frames per second, maybe something that's running at 24 frames per second, which I think is the cinematic frame rate, you can have it automatically match that, and you won't have to make any adjustments with your TV settings to do that manually. So that's a good thing. And then finally, one other kind of battery-related story that came about this week. A man in Florida says his AirPods blew up at the gym. What happened was he noticed smoke coming out of them, and luckily he took them out of his head and went to get help, because when he returned, the right AirPod had popped open, and he says there were little pieces strewn all about, and it looked like it had some burn marks on it. In the reporting, it looks like those burn marks were actually a telltale sign of a chemical runaway reaction, which is typical of a battery failure, a lithium-ion battery failure. Apple has said that they are investigating the situation, and it's unknown at this time what the cause was. As far as I know, though, we haven't seen any of the reports of AirPods blowing up, so this seems to, at least for now, be a one-off incident. Probably not too much cause for concern, but if it starts happening more, this could end up being a problem for Apple. But I've had my AirPods since day one, and I have had no issues with them personally. They seem to be working great. So there's a lot of factors that could go into a battery breaking down and the chemical reaction, the runaway reaction happening. Being Florida, one thing I would wonder about is, you know, excessive heat. If the AirPods had been left in a hot car for extended period of times, that could compromise the battery. So, you know, you need to take care of your devices that have lithium ion batteries. I'm not saying that's what happened in this case. We really don't know. But logic dictates that we haven't seen AirPods blowing up all over the place. So there's got to be some circumstances here. And hopefully Apple will get to the bottom of it. And more importantly, I really hope that they disclose exactly why this happened, so there's not kind of a panic in the community of, hey, do I have to worry about my AirPods blowing up? If it happened inside someone's ear, that would be extremely horrible. And I hope that never, ever, ever happens, not just for Apple, but for anybody who might, you know, have that happen to them. That'd be terrible. So hopefully this isn't a problem. I really don't think it is. According to the Hollywood Reporter, Brian Fuller has left the project for Amazing Stories due to creative differences. I think I've mentioned before on the MacCast, Apple is scooping up new original TV content, and one of the properties that they picked up early on that I was very excited about was the Steven Spielberg series, the reboot of the Steven Spielberg series from the 80s called Amazing Stories, and that was going to be produced in part by Brian Fuller, and he has left the project over creative differences with Apple, something he's done with other projects as well. American Gods was one example of that. And the report says that that Fuller split with Apple on good terms, which is a good thing, but still a pretty big blow to Apple. They were working on a 10-episode season reboot, or still are working on a 10-episode season reboot, reportedly, of the Steven Spielberg series. Fuller supposedly wanted to take the series in a darker, more adult-like direction. For those of you who don't know what Amazing Stories was, it was little kind of adventure sci-fi stories, one-hour episodes. They were all separate stories, so it was kind of an anthology series. Think of like The Twilight Zone, but it was out in the 80s, and they were all pretty family-friendly. Fuller wanted to kind of go in a different direction, more like the Dark Mirror series on Netflix, according to the report, and that is just something Apple has not been interested in. You may remember it's been reported that Apple wants all of their original content programs to be playable on Apple TVs in their retail stores. So I'm assuming that means family friendly. Probably, you know, at the most adult it would get would be maybe PG-13 type content, I would imagine. And even there, that might get a little bit risque for the Apple store. But it certainly doesn't allow for really dark adult sexual kinds of content. A lot of the kinds of content that we do see in original series from Hulu and Netflix and HBO and Amazon and a lot of the others. And so my question to you is, do you think that not allowing more adult, edgier content onto their new original content programming might hurt Apple's chances of success? Because that kind of content is extremely popular in those other services. I can tell you from my perspective, I am super happy that Apple is choosing to go in the direction that they are going in, because we have so many other options for that kind of content. I think differentiating themselves and saying, look, we're going to be about family-friendly, you know, good content that you can watch with your family. There's just not a lot of that stuff out there. And as a parent, I really appreciate that. I know there's some stuff out there. The problem is a lot of it tends to be, you know, really campy, not very well done. And so the idea that Apple is bringing on really creative, really high-end teams to produce this content is something that I'm really excited about. And we know they are grabbing a bunch of content. Apple reportedly picked up another new TV series this week. This one's going to be a half-hour anthology series called Little America, written by Kumail Nanjiani, who plays Dinesh on Silicon Valley. He also did a movie recently with Emily Gordon called The Big Sick. It was a very popular movie, I think the top grossing independent film for 2017. It got an Oscar nomination, a really great movie. I think it's available on Netflix right now. But those two are supposedly going to create this new series. It's going to be another anthology series based on a number of true stories that were published in Epic Magazine on portraits of American immigrants. So it's going to be little stories about American immigrants and their experiences adapting to life in America. It sounds very interesting to me. And again, very talented people Apple is hiring to sort of create this new content for them. And here's kind of the full list, because I know we've been talking about a lot of these. Here's the full list of what we know, or of projects that we know are linked to Apple in their original content efforts so far. There's going to be a new space drama from Ronald D. Moore, who's done work on Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica. We have the Amazing Stories thing, which reportedly has a budget of about $5 million per episode. So Apple's investing serious money in this content as well. There's going to be three shows from Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine Studios. Reese Witherspoon herself and Jennifer Aniston are supposedly going to star in a drama based on morning show production. There is a series called Are You Sleeping, based on a book by the same title by Kathleen Barber. It's about a podcast that reopens a murder investigation and the impact and what impact it has on the life of the victim's daughter. And Sarah Koenig of Serial is actually consulting on that, which makes sense because it sounds like basically what Serial does, right? There's a comedy sketch show starring SNL veteran Kristen Wiig as well. And again, all those being produced by Hello Sunshine Studios. And then we have Apple recently signing a deal with La La Land writer and director Damien Chazelle. And then Drake supposedly, and this is the oddest one, Drake supposedly has a blank check, a quote-unquote blank check, to create his own TV shows and movies for Apple. But we don't know what he's doing or what kinds of programs he's going to be bringing to the table. But all told, it's been reported that Apple has pledged to spend about $1 billion on original programming content in 2018. Now, we still have no clue how this stuff is going to be distributed or fit into Apple's ecosystem. It could be a brand new service. It could be bolted onto Apple Music. It could be set up to drive Apple TV sales in some way. We don't really know how Apple is planning to monetize this thing, if it's a loss leader or something they're really looking to make a profit from. My gut instinct, personally, my guess is that it's either going to be part of a small add-on to Apple Music, so maybe you pay another $5 a month on top of your regular Apple Music subscription and you get the TV stuff thrown in, or that it'll end up being a completely separate service with a monthly fee. My guess is it's all about trying to drive Apple's service revenues up, which, as you may know, is one of Apple's fastest growing revenue streams. They have done very well with their services and they want to grow it, I think, by 200%, or double it basically by 2020. And having a new original programming TV service could be a great way to grow that revenue. So we'll have to see what happens. One other kind of TV related thing this week, Apple did add this week a dedicated news section to the Apple TV. So you might see that when you go back into your Apple TV or you open the TV app on your iOS devices. Apple had announced that it was coming out with dedicated sports and TV sections. They brought the sports section in a couple months ago and just added the news section this week. So you can now get news from CBS News, CNN, Fox News, Cheddar, CNBC, or Bloomberg. You do have to download and install the apps for those services if you want to access it. And in some cases, you will need to connect it to your cable provider. You need to have a cable subscription or pay a monthly subscription fee, I think, in the case of a new service like Cheddar. A couple of the other ones do have free live streaming news. I think CBS News, you don't have to connect to your cable provider or news service, but integrated, and it's showing up in kind of the front page of the TV app and on the Apple TV interface. So that's kind of the latest with Apple TV and entertainment related news this week. All right, let's talk about this iOS boot code leak. iOS boot code started showing up on GitHub this week. This is according to a story reported by Motherboard. And in case you don't know what iBoot is, it is the part of the iOS operating system, or was the part of the iOS operating system, that handled the trusted boot process. And I say was because the code that was actually leaked was older code. It was an iBoot from iOS 9.3. And after the report, Apple confirmed that they were aware of the leak. They actually had to send a Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notice to GitHub to make sure that the code got pulled. And then Apple responded to try to explain that it's really not as bad as it looks. The code had been posted on Reddit a long time ago, actually. So Apple had been aware that the code was out there and circulating in the hacker and jailbreak communities. In fact, a later report said that the source code was originally leaked by an intern who had worked at Apple and was encouraged by his friends, some friends he had in the jailbreaking community, to sneak the code out of Apple. And it was supposed to stay in this little circle of three friends, but things kind of got out of control. Not a big surprise, because we know how these things go. And eventually it leaked out to the broader community, was kind of circling around in underground circles. And then this week really became public when it showed up on GitHub. And it wasn't apparently all of the code, just some of it. But Apple said in a statement, quote, "By design, the security of our products don't depend on the secrecy of our source code. There are many layers of hardware and software protections built into our products." And they cited the fact that most people have upgraded their operating systems. In fact, nearly 95% of users are now on versions that are later than iOS 9. And Apple has integrated things into the hardware like Secure Enclave and those sorts of things. So they're playing down this leak a little bit, but I still think that they are underplaying it. Should we panic? No. Does the average consumer need to be worried? No, I don't think you need to be worried. But, you know, iOS 11 has a heritage, right? It came from somewhere. With software, you don't typically start from scratch all over every time you come out with a new version. So part of iOS 11's heritage is iOS 9. So I imagine there still could be clues. Even if it's just into the ways that Apple approaches security, there could be little breadcrumbs here and there that for sure folks who know what they're doing could follow. They can follow that trail and make some conclusions. So this being out in the community is not ultimately good for Apple. It, you know, also based on the recent set of security related stories that Apple has had, you know, they've had some pretty big security issues this year. Or in late 2017, those together with this doesn't paint Apple in a really good light when it comes to security. And another question that I have is, how does an intern working at Apple have access to low-level boot code? That seemed a little bit odd to me as well. If that's really the source of the leak, and it looks like it is, it's been confirmed by multiple sources, you know, that's kind of a big deal. And all of that might be the bigger bit of damage, you know, more so than the code getting out into the community. Just the damage to Apple's reputation is a pretty big deal here. So something Apple's going to have to deal with, and they're certainly going to have to work on. But with that, you know, that's it. That's all we got really for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a moment, though, and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Small Dog Electronics. You know, I am so happy that Small Dog is on board because, you know, the MacCast, we're a community podcast. We're all about the Apple community. And Small Dog has really been a staple of the Apple and Mac community forever. They've been around since 1995. They started shipping products out to Apple customers from their living room. And they've grown to a really great company that serves our community. But they're not, you know, a big conglomerate warehouse store. These are real people. They have real dogs. You can look on their website. You can get information, including, you know, phone numbers and stuff like that. They're real people that you can reach, and they offer really great personal service, the kind of service you'd expect from a friend in the Mac community. And they offer an amazing selection of new and refurbished Mac and Apple products and accessories on their website at smalldog.com. And in fact, listen to this. They gave me the inside scoop and said there should be some refurbished 13 and 15-inch MacBook Pros coming in from Apple. about the time that you hear this, so it might be a good time to visit their refurbished and clearance section at smalldog.com to see if you can get a deal. And they offer also a growing selection of home automation products, HomeKit compatible stuff. So maybe if you got a new HomePod and you want to expand your HomeKit products in your home, you want to check out SmallDog for that as well. And make sure you go to the site frequently and connect with them on their Facebook page, because they're constantly posting new deals. Almost daily, there's a new deal going up. So you can get a really, really, really great deal. And you get no sales tax on most orders and free shipping on orders over $75. And they'll ship out the same day if you can get your order in before 3 p.m. Eastern time. And finally, for MacCast listeners, they're giving us a coupon code. You can save even more if you use the code MACCAST at checkout, M-A-C-C-A-S-T. You're going to get $20 off any order of $100 or more. So check them out. Smalldog.com is the address. And a huge thank you to SmallDog for their support of the MACCAST. So let's follow up on a few things from the last couple episodes. One thing we had been talking about is discussing ways to handle having multiple iTunes accounts in multiple countries. There's a lot of people that either travel around, or maybe you want to get access to some content that's not maybe available in your home country. And we've talked about ways that you can have separate accounts. That part is pretty easy, but paying for those things is a little bit difficult, because if you have a credit card tied to a certain country, you're not able to use that in the iTunes store of another country. So one way around that potentially is to use iTunes gift cards. But how do you get an iTunes gift card from a different country? And I mentioned that, and even to the degree where, hey, what if I want to send a gift, an iTunes gift card, to a friend who's in another country? How do I do that? I can't buy one from the US store, and gift cards are locked to the store that you, the iTunes store that you purchased them in. Well, MacCast listener Bebe, who lives in New Zealand, she emailed in and said, hey, I've been using this great service for a long time, PC Game Supply, PCGameSupply.com, and I've had great experience with the service. Now, I'm not familiar with this service. I did a quick Google search. They seem to have great reviews and ratings. A lot of people in the gaming community use them for gaming gift cards, I guess. And, you know, I don't know anything about them. I trust Bebe because she's been a MacCast listener for a long time. Great member of our community. But, you know, please use your best judgment. Do your own research and check it out. But it seems like a really great option. And thanks to her for sharing that with us. Some other follow-up, thanks to the many of you who confirmed my issues with the iPad Pro keyboard. I mentioned that my iPad Pro keyboard I love, but it has this weird issue where it will suddenly become disconnected. So it'll be working, I'll be able to type on it, and then all of a sudden the on-screen keyboard will pop up. And I have to kind of tilt it, or just, you know, pull it forward and push it back, and then eventually it kind of re-engages. Well, apparently I am not alone, because I received this comment from Barry.
Hey, Adam, it's Barry from Chicago. Just responding to Glenn's question around the fiddly keyboard. I've had the same problem with both my iPad Pros, both the 10.5-inch and the 12.9. So I'm pretty comfortable with the software issue. Like you, I just kind of do some voodoo and try to get it back, sometimes killing a couple of apps, sometimes invoking something unusual like enabling dictation. I know that fixed it once. But it does seem to kind of prop up, especially around the beta. So like you, I'm going to provide feedback, and hopefully this can be addressed. Take care.
Hey, Barry, thanks a lot for reporting in on that. Yeah, and Barry wasn't the only one. I received a number of emails from you, so thanks to everyone who emailed in. And a few others have confirmed that the, you know, getting a hardware replacement, because I had mine replaced once. A couple other of you said I had mine replaced, you know, two or three times. Replacements don't seem to fix the issue. So that also does, Barry, seem to confirm that it's very likely a software issue. Although, you know, there could be a hardware problem too, because I did a little more testing with mine. And what seems to be able to get it back is a, you know, like I said, tweaking, just kind of pulling the screen forward and then letting it drop back works almost all the time for me. And I started playing with that a little bit more. And what I discovered is I think it might be a touchy sensor. I think there's a little sensor, maybe a magnet that triggers it when you put it into keyboard mode, right? It has that little plastic groove that the iPad Edge with the smart connector sort of rests in. And what I've noticed is if I wiggle that area, that can trigger the on-screen keyboard coming up and down. So if I kind of pull it forward to where it's not quite in that groove, just a hair, it doesn't take very much to trigger it, then this issue pops up. So I think it's somewhat related to that. And I don't know if it's something that they can fix in software. Hopefully it is, because it's really annoying when you're trying to use the smart keyboard and it's not working and I'm constantly having to do this back and forth thing. Consequently, I also think that's where it comes disconnected when I'm using it, is like if I'm typing on the keyboard, if it jiggles just enough, or even more frequently, if I reach up to touch the screen, it's sort of pushing the screen, especially near the top edge, is enough to kind of push it out of that groove and cause this thing to trigger like that. So hopefully there's a software fix, but good to know that, you know, it's not just me and that, well, that's not even nice. It's good to know that other people have exactly the same problem and are just as frustrated as I am. I know that sounds bad, but you know what I mean. It's good to know that you're not alone when you're suffering some sort of strange problem with an iOS device. So again, thanks to the community for confirming all of that. Another thing we talked about recently was kind of ways that you can do iOS support. You know, we don't really have remote control of iOS devices yet. And somebody reported in that, you know, you can use the new screen recording feature to record a little video of what someone might need to do on their iOS device and send that to them. That's a new feature in iOS 11. And I thought that was a great tip, but I was still kind of looking for that solution that was kind of a true remote access solution. Well, turns out we are one step closer to that, thanks to another new technology related to the screen recording that's built into iOS 11. Many of you wrote in to tell me about the latest version of the TeamViewer software, TeamViewer 13. And I'll link to TeamViewer in the show notes at mattcast.com. But in the new version, it uses iOS 11's new replay kit, which is the thing that lets you stream video to a streaming video service, say like Twitch or YouTube's gaming channel or whatever it might be, right? This was mainly for gamers so they could share, you know, video sessions of their gaming. Well, you can also use it to send to like messaging apps, or in the case of TeamViewer, it's a kind of a remote collaboration app, and they added the support to do that in TeamViewer 13. So what you need is the TeamViewer app on your Mac, and then the person whose iOS device you're trying to troubleshoot, they need to download and install the TeamViewer Quick Support app. It's a free app they can download from the App Store. And when they open up that app, they give you an ID number that you plug into your TeamViewer app software running on your Mac. And that will allow you to connect to their iOS device. They'll get a little pop-up message saying, hey, someone's trying to connect to your device. Do you want to allow access? And once they say okay, then you'll be there in TeamViewer. You get a little chat interface so you can send messages back and forth. But then what you want to do is in the Mac app, you want to go to the screen sharing tab and tap the screen sharing button. And then it will give you some instructions to give to the iOS person, which is basically to turn on their screen recording. So what they'll do is they'll access the control center and then force press on the screen recording icon. And if they don't have the screen recording icon in control center, you'll need to have them go into the control center settings. So settings, control center, and add the screen recording icon. Then go back to control center, force press on the screen recording icon, and then that will pop up a list of sources, or in this case, I guess, really destinations that you can broadcast to. They may have to scroll up to see TeamViewer, but TeamViewer should be in that list. So select that, and then they tap on Start Broadcast. And once they start broadcasting, it'll give them a 3-2-1 countdown. Then you will be able to see their screen in the TeamViewer app on your Mac, and then you can walk them through tech support. It's really pretty cool. I tried this out, and it worked pretty well. It was a little tricky to get started, right? There's a lot of steps to kind of make that connection, but once you understand it and get through it, it works really well. And there's not a lot of latency. I was able to see what was going on the screen very easily, and I think it's a really good support option. And you can use it all for free. Now, TeamViewer does have a commercial paid version, but for personal use, you are allowed to use the app for free. So that is a great option. And it's not just TeamViewer. There's other software, I guess, that seems to be integrating this. As a matter of fact, Gary says you can do something similar with Zoom. He sent in this comment.
Hey, Adam, Gary. Pretty excited about this. I know that you just finished up a great podcast and talked about the ability for people to get assistance remotely. And I think the additional suggestion was that you can do a screen recording and you can send that to the person so they can help troubleshoot. In thinking that a little bit further, and I do a lot of video conferencing, I noticed there is additional options if you long press. And I think you mentioned it that you have to long press to turn on the audio. But if you have additional conferencing software installed on your device, you can also access that. One of the software I use is called Zoom, and they have a free tier for basic personal meetings, and it's free. And the recipient does not need to have the account. You just need to have an account to actually create the meeting for someone to join. You do have to have the software on your phone to join, but no account's very easy. So what really excites me about it is you can share your iPhone screen for troubleshooting. So the process to do that is, if you're the host like myself and I want to assist somebody perhaps in another state or away, I can send them my Zoom link for a conference. They can follow the link either in an email or just paste it in their browser. It opens Zoom on their phone. If they don't already have it, it'll prompt them to download it from the App Store. Same thing on an iPad, probably the same on a computer as well. And once they're in there, they can use their video on their phone, the audio on their phone. But once the call is already initiated, you can slide up from the bottom or the top, depending on which device you have, and then long press on the record screen, choose the option to share screen through Zoom, and it initiates screen sharing. So I just thought that's amazing. Amazing. So thanks. Wanted to share that with everyone.
Hey, thanks, Gary, as always. Yeah, This is really cool. We're kind of entering this new phase where we're able to do this, something a lot of us have wanted to be able to do for a long time. I still wish Apple would open up their system, because their system is much more elegant. If anybody has ever gone through Apple Care over the phone with an iOS device and seen this working, it's amazing. They have the ability to kind of just send you a link and you click on it on your iOS device, and suddenly a representative from Apple can completely control your screen, and you can see what they're doing, you can see the taps and presses that they're doing, and it's really cool. But barring that, I guess we have these other options, and this is going to be a good measure until something else like that, until maybe Apple makes something like that available. I also mentioned on the last episode that the one thing that is missing from this is the ability to actually see where someone is touching or pressing on their iPhone, and Marty wrote in to give us a little like kind of workaround for that using accessibility and assistive touch and something called custom gestures. So what you can do is you can actually go into the settings, general accessibility options on your phone, and tap on assistive touch. And assistive touch will, when you enable it, bring up this little white icon that appears floating on your iPhone screen. And it's used to be able to trigger a bunch of gestures. And one of the kinds of things that it can do is it gives you the ability to create your own gestures. So it's a lot of it is for situations where maybe somebody doesn't have enough motor coordination to do like a pinch to zoom or those sorts of things. And this gives you the ability with one finger, after tapping and selecting a gesture, to kind of do those gestures with just one finger or limited manipulation. And you can create your own gestures with this. So you tap on assistive touch, you turn it on, and then you can hit create new gesture to create one. And in that new gesture screen, what you can do is just tap once to create a tap gesture. name the gesture something like probably tap, and then tap the save button. And now what will happen is you'll see that little white assistive touch icon hovering above your screen. And when once you've started your screen recording or broadcast, what you ask the person to do is tap the assistive touch button, then tap on custom, and then they can tap on the gesture they created. So the gesture called, in this case, maybe tap. So you tap on that, and what it'll do is it'll place a little circle icon on the screen, and then anytime you tap, what it'll do is that little circle icon will go to that section and actually initiate the tap. But the good news for remote support is that means you'll be able to see wherever that circle icon appears, that's where the person tapped on the screen. And this will need to be re-enabled each time they open a different app, so it kind of resets itself every time an app opens, so they'll have to tap on the assistive touch button, tap on custom, and then tap on the tap gesture that they had created. But at least you'll be able to see where they're tapping on the screen, and that might be helpful. Again, Apple's own thing that they use does all of this kind of automatically. I think it puts the little sort of white circle on the screen. But hey, we have some workarounds that we can use for doing remote iOS support. And this is great stuff. So thank you to everyone in the community who has been writing in and commenting. And again, I'll have links to both the Zoom service and the TeamViewer service in the show notes at maccast.com. All right, I kind of buried the lead this week because I want to get into HomePod. Apple released HomePod. It came out on Friday. I went down to my local Apple store for in-store pickup on my HomePod. I was super excited about it. I wasn't sure what to expect at the Apple store, if there was going to be big lines, if there was going to be a lot of people. There were a lot of people there, but it turns out most of them were there to get new iPhone batteries. In fact, and I don't know what to read into this or not read into this, I was the only person at my local Apple store that morning there to pick up a HomePod. So not a lot of people rushing in to get the HomePod, but I have a feeling this is going to be a slow burner. I think it's going to be like a lot of Apple's products recently where they need to get in the hands of people. People need to feel, hear, and touch them, hear them really in the case of the HomePod, to be really sucked into it. And I have to tell you, it's going to be easy to fall in love with a HomePod once you actually experience it. Now, before we even get into anything, I need to talk about the fact that sound and how anybody perceives sound is completely subjective. So what I like might not be what you like, because we're going to be talking about the sound and the quality of the HomePod, because that's what a lot of people want to know about. And I have to say, for me, I think it sounds amazing. I love the sound of it. It does have a heavy bass response. You might hear some people talking about the fact that there is a lot of bass. But here's the thing, you know, in my mind, bass isn't that bad. I like bass sound. What I don't like is when the bass is so overwhelming that you can't hear anything else in the sound profile. And that is definitely not the case with the HomePod. The bass is there when you want it, when it's supposed to be there, I think, for the track that you're listening to. But everything is completely separated. So you get the bass, but you still get all the mids and the great highs. And the highs are amazing in this thing. They're bright and clear and crisp. Voices, the vocal tracks aren't drowned out even when there's heavy bass. And I have been hearing things. I've been listening to the HomePod all weekend, and I am hearing things in my music that I have never heard before, things that I didn't know were there. Now, I'm not an audiophile. I probably don't have the best equipment, but I have decent equipment. I have a Sonos system in my living room. That's not cheap stuff. It's good stuff. And I'm still hearing things with the HomePod that I've never heard before. And speaking of the Sonos, I did set up and try and do a little A-B testing. Now, I just have a Sonos Play 1, so that's what I was comparing it to. I'd love to be able to compare it to a Sonos Play 5 or a Play 3. The Play 3, I think, is almost directly in line with the pricing of the HomePod, but other reviews have said it, at the very least, holds its own with the Sonos Play 3 or Play 5, and in some instances, some reviews are saying it even sounds better. Now, with the Sonos Play 1, here's the deal. In my mind, the HomePod had a sort of much fuller and richer sound. It also offered a little bit more separation. Both were very good. I still love my Sonos Play 1s, and right now you can get a pair of Sonos 1s for the same price as a single HomePod. So that's something to consider. But overall, I think the sound of the HomePod for me was a little bit better. The Sonos Play 1, it definitely didn't have the kind of bass range for sure. The lows weren't there. It was great in the mids and the highs, but it also kind of had a sound. I called it almost like a hall sound, almost like it had a presence effect put on it, where it was just a little more distant. Still perfectly fine. It sounded more like a live concert. There was, like, I don't know if it was reverb or echo, and I compared a whole range of different kinds of music on it, and just overall, I felt like the HomePod was giving a much broader, fuller experience, is the best way I could describe it to you. But again, this is all personal stuff. You might hear something in the Sonos that I don't, and you might prefer the sound of that. So I would say HomePod is something you definitely, probably, if you're on the fence, want to go listen to. You know, go into an Apple store, take a listen to it, and see what you think. Another part of HomePod, of course, is the Siri experience. And I have to tell you this, you know, even though the functionality is limited, right, the HomePod is specifically tuned to specific tasks like music, for one. You know, anything related to music, Siri on the HomePod, hands down, is amazing. It can give you all kinds of music information on the tracks. I was asking her all kinds of things about, you know, who produced this album, when was this song written, who sings on this album, who plays drums on this track. You know, all that information she could just rattle off instantaneously. She also knows about movies, so you can ask about movies and TV shows, and you can get information on that. So her wealth of knowledge related to entertainment-based content with the HomePod has been, you know, extremely expanded, and it works very, very well. Some of the other things, you can, you know, set reminders, you can ask her to set timers, although you can only do one timer at a time. You can do alarms, a few other things, but it's not the full Siri that you're going to get on your iPhone. But that said, with the stuff that Siri on HomePod can do, it is by far the absolute best Siri experience I have ever had. And I've had pretty good Siri experiences, but the fact that she can pick up my voice from not only anywhere in the room, but even anywhere, not anywhere, but even in places outside the room. So my living room is sort of just outside my office on the other side of a wall. We can be in the living room watching TV, and we can activate the lights and control HomeKit stuff from Siri on the HomePod in the office without screaming, just talking at a normal volume or slightly raised volume. She will pick that up and work perfectly. And that is just unbelievable. And certainly when I'm in the office, even with loud music playing, even with the music going, I can speak in a normal voice and she will respond and hear me perfectly almost every time. And that is just incredible. I am loving it. If you can't tell, it's been great all weekend hanging out with Siri here in the office, just listening to great tunes and doing that sort of stuff. So needless to say, I am already a fan. I've already mentioned, I think, you know, to me, it's the same experience that I had with my AirPods. You know, I was hesitant about buying the AirPods. They were expensive. I wasn't sure how much I was going to like them. And immediately I started falling in love with them. I can see the same thing happening with HomePod. It's like you don't think you need it. You think it's a little bit too expensive. Maybe you don't want to spend that money just on a speaker. But then you get it, you have it, and it's just magical. The setup experience was seamless. Just tapped my device to it. It instantly got all my account information connected to my network. That was flawless. Just an amazing, amazing experience. So a couple other things about HomePod. A lot of people want to know, can I get two HomePods? Are they going to work together? Can I use them as a stereo pair? Can I use them in separate rooms and have music playing across two rooms? The short answer is yes. The longer answer is a lot of that stuff hasn't come yet. It's coming later this year, especially the thing for multi-room audio that requires AirPlay 2. We don't know when that's going to happen. What we have heard is that the ability to use two HomePods as kind of a quote-unquote stereo pair, and I'm saying in quotes, stereo pair for a very specific reason, that is supposedly coming soon. It's going to come before the multi-room audio in AirPlay 2. And the reason I'm saying stereo pair in quotes is that it's not true stereo, because when people think about stereo, you think, okay, I'm going to put one on the left and only the left sounds are going to come out of the left HomePod, and then I'm going to put one on the right and only the right sounds are going to come out of the right HomePod. That's not how it's going to work. Apple has said they're going to basically automatically detect and balance that pair using their beamforming technology to create a, quote, wider and more immersive soundscape. So I don't know exactly what that means, but I'm guessing what they're doing is rather than just making a stereo pair, a left and a right, they're going to take and look at and analyze the music that's playing. They're going to analyze your space. They're going to analyze where those speakers are placed, right? Because that's what the HomePod does. Is this one near a wall? Is this one more open? What's around the thing? And they're going to tweak that audio profile so that you get the right sound coming. So it's going to sound like stereo, probably even better than stereo, but it's not going to be a true quote-unquote stereo. So just a little point of clarification. I think for most people, it's not really going to matter because it's going to sound amazing. And, you know, the reason this thing sounds amazing is Apple has gone through extensive testing on this thing. They brought a bunch of reporters to their campus to show their audio testing facilities, and they have these amazing rooms with floors that are completely isolated from the outside of the building. They've got all these materials on them for sound dampening, these anechoic test chambers, and as a matter of fact, they have one that is said to be the biggest in the U.S. for testing this stuff. And it's the same stuff they use for testing iPhones and all these other sorts of things, but it's incredible. So there is just 6 years of engineering that has gone into the HomePod, and I think it all shows in terms of the overall quality of the product itself, the build quality, but just the sound on this is unbelievable. By far the best sounding speaker of its size that I have ever owned. The controls for it are very, very simple. You have the little panel on the top that is a touch panel. It doesn't have a true LCD display, although it does have a little LED color array under it that gives you the swirling colors when Siri has been activated. But beyond Siri, there really is nothing displayed on the display other than a little plus icon and a minus icon for raising or lowering the volume from the device. You can, of course, also do that with Siri, just asking her to set the volume to whatever percentage you want it set to. But then the controls on top, the way they work is you can tap to play pause, you double tap to skip forward, you triple tap to skip back, and you tap and hold to manually invoke Siri if you want. And speaking of Siri, I thought this was interesting. You know, how does Siri know what device to respond to? So like I'm sitting in my office, right? I have an Apple Watch on that has Siri. I have an iPhone that has Siri. I have an iPad Pro that has Siri. And they will all trigger if I issue the magic Siri commands. And I'm not going to do that because I don't want to set off people's HomePods. We're back to the other problem with HomePod is, right, anybody can say the magic Siri command and it will work. So if I said it and you had a HomePod in your room right now, it would probably go off and try and do something. So I'm not going to say it. But, how does she know what to respond to? And how does the HomePod know when to pick up versus any one of my other devices? Well, this gets really interesting. So what happens is Siri will pull all of the devices very quickly over Bluetooth to figure out which one should answer. And most of the time, if you have a HomePod in the room, the HomePod is going to attempt to handle the request. Now, this is both good and bad because it's good because the HomePod is the best listening device probably in the room. The bad part is that the HomePod, again, is limited in terms of the Siri commands that it can handle. So if it's one that you need your iPhone or other device to respond to, that can be a little bit frustrating. And I had that experience over the weekend. So I want to get into how this works, because this might be able to help you if you need to access Siri on one of the other devices that's in the same room as your HomePod. But basically what happens is that if another device is currently active, like you've just raised your wrist on your Apple Watch and the screen just became active, or if you're actively engaged with a device like your iPhone, so if you're looking at your iPhone 10 and it knows it's in front of you, then that is the device that's going to respond and handle the request. That's going to supersede the HomePod. So if you need to use it on your iPhone, just pick up your iPhone, have the screen active, and then say the magic Siri command, and Siri on your iPhone should handle it. I've already had issues with my Apple Watch taking over when I wanted the HomePod to respond, because I'll move in my chair. So if I've just put my hand up, or I've turned my wrist or something like that, just in the natural, I raised my hands up to start typing on my keyboard, and if it's at that moment that my watch just activated and then I'm trying to issue a command to the HomePod, very often the Apple Watch will try to handle the request, and that has sort of lessened the HomePod experience a little bit. So I'm learning in some cases to just put my hand over my Apple Watch, which I shouldn't have to do. I think Apple needs a little bit more fine tuning and tweaking on this, but put my hand over my Apple Watch to make sure it doesn't respond instead of the HomePod. So just some things to think about if you get a HomePod in your environment, especially if you have multiple Apple devices trying to operate in the same room. It's like, how do you get Siri on the device that you want? Most of the time, it works perfectly fine. And it's really funny with the HomePod to have other devices in the room and you say the magic Siri command, everything kind of lights up, but then very quickly, the devices that aren't the HomePod shut down, and then HomePod handles the request. So that's how that all works. And that was very interesting. A few HomePod settings that I think you probably should know about. One thing is that most of the HomePod settings are accessed from the Home app. So HomePod is added to HomeKit and the Home app, and you'll find it. You'll find a lot of the settings for it under the HomePod icon there by either tapping and holding, or long pressing on it, or force pressing on it, and then tapping Details. You can get into more information. One thing that people want to know about is the listening history. So HomePod is tied to one Apple Music account, to one iCloud account, and that means that anything you play on it by default will go in and affect the For You suggestions that are in Apple Music. If you don't want that to happen, what you can do is you can turn off the Use Listening History option in the settings in the Home app for your HomePod. So if you turn that off, anything that plays on the HomePod is not going to influence the For You suggestions that are in your Apple Music. So if you're in a multifamily household and, maybe your kids are going to be using the HomePod, you may want to turn off the Use Listening History so that doesn't affect your own personal suggestions and things like that. Another thing that you may or may not want to turn off is something called personal requests. This is the thing that gives the HomePod the ability to, say, read your text messages or send a text message on your behalf, which is something that it can do. Once again, it's tied to one account in the house. You will need to be in the house and on the Wi-Fi to be able to use this feature. If you leave the house, it will detect and know that you're not on the Wi-Fi network and will not allow that feature to work. I think you can also set a password, or at least a notification, to know when someone's trying to send a text message and you're not in the house. But if you want to just disable that completely, again, you can open the Home app on your iOS device, go up and tap on the little location arrow icon this time in the upper left-hand corner of the screen, and then under the People section, you're going to want to tap on your profile picture. So this is the section that's going to show everybody that you've invited to share your HomeKit applications, or to allow remote access on your HomeKit stuff. So tap your profile picture, and then under the Siri on HomePod, toggle on or off the personal requests button. So that's how you change that setting. You can also, in this same area, control access to AirPlay. So by default, anyone on your home network will be able to see an AirPlay content to your HomePod. If you want to change that, again, you're going to launch the Home app. You're going to tap the Home tab, tap on that little geolocation button in the upper left-hand corner, and then choose Home Settings, select your home network, and then tap the Allow Speaker Access option. And from there, you can set the level of access that you want. Your options are everyone, anyone on the same network, which is the default, or only people sharing this home. And those are going to be the people that you invited or that you added as temporary guests in your home to be able to control your HomeKit devices. So you have those three settings and you can tweak those. You also have the ability to set a password that would be required when someone tries to AirPlay content to your HomePod. So if you want to lock it down with a password, you can do that as well. So again, all of those settings you're going to find in the Home app for your HomePod. A few people have asked, hey, is there a way to change the sound profile on the HomePod? You know, I want to be able to do like an EQ. Can I manually adjust and maybe turn down that bass if I don't like the sound of it? You actually can't. The HomePod by default is going to use analytics, and it actually, according to Apple and Eddie Q, intelligently sets the levels for each individual song. So depending upon the profile of the song, it will adapt and kind of set the equalizer automatically for that track. You can't really do anything to change that. The one little trick that you can do is if you are sending music from an app over AirPlay, something like iTunes does have an EQ built into it, so you could tweak the audio in that EQ, but you're going to have to do it over AirPlay, and you're going to have to be using an app that supports tweaking the audio profile before it gets sent over to the HomePod. So that's a little workaround, but as of right now, Apple's not giving you really any controls to adjust the profile of the sound profile of the HomePod itself. Another question has been, can you control HomePod playback and volume from an iOS device? Do you have to use Siri and the voice controls, or do you have to walk up to the HomePod and tap the buttons on it? Are those the only way to control volume and playback? And the answer turns out to be no, although it's not really obvious when you first get the HomePod. So what you can do is while the HomePod is playing, if you go into the control center on an iOS device that is on the same Wi-Fi network, you can actually access controls. You can see what's playing on the HomePod. You can get information about it, and you can get little player controls. So the way you do this is you force press or long press on the music player controls in the control center. You can also tap on the little, it looks like a little Wi-Fi or network icon up in the upper right-hand corner. Tap on that. That'll bring up the main music player for your phone. But then you should also, under that, see if something's playing on the HomePod and you're connected to the HomePod. You'll see the HomePod. You also might see other Bluetooth speakers or other Bluetooth devices or Wi-Fi speakers in that list. But you can tap on the HomePod panel, and that will bring up the controls for the HomePod. So you'll see the track information, you'll see the album art, a little scrubber, the play, pause, and skip controls, and you also have the manual volume control. So you can control it from there. You can also access all of this from the music app. So if you go into the music app on your iOS device and tap on the player control down at the little bottom to bring up the player control sheet, and then tap on the AirPlay icon, you will see the same options for your HomePod. Again, if you're on a Wi-Fi network with a HomePod connected. So there is the ability from your iOS device to control all of that. And that is not AirPlay. Even though you're tapping on the AirPlay icon, you're just controlling what's already playing directly on your HomePod. Some people have asked or complained about the fact that you can't set more than one timer at a time on the HomePod. This seems like a misstep from Apple. I hope they change this, but there is a little clever workaround. You can set alarms and reminders on your HomePod, so you could use those in lieu of a timer and essentially have the same effect, right? You can say, Magic Siri command, remind me to take the chicken out of the oven in 30 minutes. And then 30 minutes will go by and you will get a reminder from Siri. And you can set as many reminders as you want. You could also say, Magic Siri command, set an alarm for take the chicken out of the oven in 30 minutes. And she will happily do that. And you can set multiple alarms. You can mix and match. So there really is a workaround for that. Why Apple wouldn't allow more than one timer? You know, the HomePod has an A8 processor. I'm sure it can handle many, many timers going on at once. It doesn't just have, you know, kind of one clock in it. So hopefully they change that. That just seems like a weird limitation. But yeah. And then another big question I've received about HomePod is, can I use HomePod with my Apple TV? You know, can I use it as like my home theater speaker? And the answer is yes, it is somewhat limited. You need to use AirPlay for that to send your movie audio, but you can do that and you can access it in a couple ways. One is you can press and hold the play button on the main screen of your Apple TV. So when you're on the app launcher screen, press and hold the play button, and that will give you the audio selection choices, and you can select your HomePod under there as an AirPlay device, and then it'll start outputting the audio to your HomePod. Also, while you're playing a video, you can simply swipe down and then tap on the audio options, and then you should be able to see and select your HomePod from there as well. So you can play the audio that way. And something I discovered was that you can control what's playing on your HomePod, just like you can from your iOS device. You can control that from the Apple TV. And this includes selecting music from your music library and playing it on the Apple TV. Now, I'm running tvOS 11.3 beta, so I'm not sure if this is only in 11.3 or if it's also available in 11.2.5. So I apologize if it's not in the earlier version. So if it's not in there now, it's at least coming. But what you can do is from the main screen, like I said, press and hold the play pause button on the Siri remote. This will bring up the audio selection interface. And then from there, you'll see a choose music option for the Apple TV. But then if you have a HomePod, you'll also see choose music for your HomePod. So if you swipe over and select choose music on the HomePod, it'll bring up the music app and you can browse through, look for your music, look for your favorite playlist, hit play, and it'll start playing on your HomePod. And when you're in that interface, you are now controlling the HomePod with the Siri remote. So all of the Siri controls will work. You can use the volume up and volume down buttons on the Siri remote to change the volume on your HomePod. And you can also then swipe through and access your music. You can get information on it. If you want to change the sources, there is a little AirPlay icon up in the upper left-hand corner. You can go up to that, tap on it, and you can switch between controlling your Apple TV audio or controlling the HomePod audio. And that is pretty cool. And then also, if you have a HomePod playing in the Apple TV's music app, if you go to the Now Playing screen, you can access that little AirPlay icon in the upper left-hand corner. And again, you will see the HomePod and you can control the music over there. And if you select that again, pressing the volume up, volume down will change the volume, and you can get access to all of the HomePod controls from your Apple TV. And that is pretty cool. The other thing that I noted is that if you are playing audio from your Apple TV to your HomePod, you can control the video playback from the HomePod itself. So you can say things like, hey, lady, skip back. I have to be very careful. I want to say that magic word, and I'm not going to do it. Hey, lady, skip back or go back 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and it will rewind the video, you know, take you back that far in your video. You can ask it to pause or play, those sorts of things. So you get some basic Siri commands, and you can do all of that without having to use the button on the Siri remote. You can just issue the magic Siri words and do that when you have it connected to your Apple TV. Now, one thing you need to know about this is that it is AirPlay, so it's not going to remain connected. If you use the HomePod for something else, like playing music just through your voice, that is going to disconnect it from the Apple TV, and you're going to have to go back in, you know, press and hold the play pause button from the main screen or do the thing from the video player where you swipe down and go to the audio controls and reselect the HomePod as your AirPlay output device each time you go back to play a movie. So just be aware of that. It's not, you know, it's not seamless, but it is possible. And many people seem to want to be able to use a HomePod for their home theater setup. And I think that's going to be a popular use case for it. And it seems like Apple has thought about it. And I'm sure it's going to get better. So there's that. Another thing that has come up is, what about repairing a HomePod? What's it going to cost if I have a problem with my HomePod, if I need to get serviced and I'm out of warranty? Apple has come out with the numbers. They say it's a flat fee of $279. So it's not inexpensive, and that's for any damage that isn't covered under the normal warranty or once you're out of warranty. So if you're considering buying a HomePod, it's $39 to get AppleCare Plus. That would add an additional year of coverage. I didn't get it on mine. I'm now kind of second-guessing myself and thinking, maybe I should have wanted to, or maybe I should have got it. I don't really know. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of things that could go wrong with an AirPod, with a HomePod, but you never know. You know, I don't think it's going to fall off the shelf and get damaged, but maybe something could happen. The power cord is certainly something to think about. There was some question on whether or not the power cord was user removable. There is a scary video on 9to5Mac. A brave new HomePod owner decided to pull on that cord and see if it was actually user removable. And it turns out it is. But man, it is scary. You have to pull really hard. There is a loud snap when that thing pops out, but it does have a little kind of proprietary special connector in there. I would advise that you don't do this because Apple officially says that it's not user replaceable. If you need to replace a faulty or damaged power cord out of warranty, it's going to be $29 to have Apple do it. I would just have them do it. I don't really want to try it myself after seeing this video, but supposedly you can, I mean, you can pull that out of there. Again, I wouldn't do it. I'd be worried that it would damage my, you know, $349 speaker. So I'm just giving you the information and advising you very strongly, don't do it. So if you do it and something happens to your HomePod, I'm absolving myself right now. But yeah, I mean, I, you know, just to finish this off, the HomePod is amazing. It is very pricey. I think it's not for everyone. You know, if you are invested in some other platform, like if you are super happy with your Sonos system or Sonos is the thing for you, if you're all in on Amazon and Alexa, then go for that. You know, those are great, great options. I think the thing here is there's a lot of reporting going on, a lot of people trying to compare HomePod to either Alexa or Sonos or these other systems. In my mind, it's really in a category of its own. It's really for a specific consumer. It's for people like myself who are big Apple fans. We're heavily invested in the Apple ecosystem. I'm all about HomeKit. I'm all about Apple Music and iTunes. I have everything on my iPhone or an iOS device. Everything's in iCloud. I live in that ecosystem. And if that is you and you're looking for a great standalone speaker that's going to work well in that, you know, with all those other things and be seamlessly integrated and sound incredibly awesome, then the HomePod is it. The HomePod is for you. And, you know, I think Apple's really targeting that market. And I think it's going to expand. I think it's going to get better. Is it going to support third-party music services? I think someday, but it could be a year. It could be longer before Apple does that. I think what they're going to do is they're going to get all the early adopters, all the people that are in the target market that they want to reach right now, and then they'll slowly expand it out. We've seen them do this with other products like the iPhone, like the iPod back in the day, right? It wasn't on Windows from day one, but it eventually ended up there. I think it's going to be the same sort of thing. I think it's going to be, you know, a thing that's set up to help Apple pull more people into the Apple ecosystem, try and pull more people into Apple Music. And once they've exhausted that sort of group, then they'll start to expand and move it on. So I think it'll get there eventually. But, you know, if you want it today, if you want it now, you've got to kind of be in the Apple ecosystem. And I'm really kind of okay with that. I'm very happy with that. And I think Apple's happy just targeting those customers. So, you know, I think generally the reviews have been very positive. There's a lot of people that are sort of angry about HomePod. And what I get from that, what it seems to me, is there's a lot of reviewers out there that love the technology that HomePod brings, right? They're geeks, they're nerds, and it's got some amazing stuff in it. They love the sound of HomePod, and it just frustrates them that, hey, I'm a Spotify user. I love Spotify. I want this speaker, but I still want to use Spotify, and Apple's telling me I can't have that. And that makes them very angry. And so they tend to give a negative review. The good guys make it balanced and say, look, you know, I get it. I understand that this isn't going to be for me because I'm a Spotify person, but I can still appreciate what Apple has done here. But then you have the other ones that are just bitter that they can't have this great piece of technology because it's locked into Apple's ecosystem and they don't want to play in that ecosystem. Well, yep, too bad. You're not going to be able to do it, or you're going to have to wait. So that's the case. But yeah, I love my HomePod. If you have more questions about the HomePod, if you want me to test something, there's something you want to have me try out, I'm very open. That's why I have it. And that's why we have our community. So shoot me an email, audio comment, a question. If you have a HomePod and you found a great tip or trick for us, please share those with us. Or if you just want to share your experience with HomePod and what you think, I welcome those as well. So send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. All right, I want to finish up with a little thing related to iTunes and iOS backups, because this is something I've often wondered about. And there was a great piece. A lot of this information comes from a Macworld piece by Glenn Fleischman, super smart guy. I'll link to the article in the show notes at maccast.com. But unfortunately, he had a reader write in and said, you know, I lost my photos and I was hoping to recover them out of my iOS backup. When I went to do it, they weren't there. And so the question became, yeah, well, what is in your iOS backups? Like, what is there? And what is, more importantly, what is not there? And so he went into what is not in your iOS backups, and I thought this was good for us to go over. So what's not in your iOS backups is your apps. All of your apps are re-downloaded when you erase and reinstall or reset up an iPhone or an iPad or any iOS device. Anybody who's been through that process knows that's the case because it's a little bit painful, but the idea is that all those apps are available on the App Store. Apple knows what apps you have installed and what you've purchased, so they'll just re-download those and reinstall them, so they don't need to back those up. Music is not backed up. Obviously, the stuff, if you are directly connecting your device and you're syncing from the stuff that's stored on your Mac, you know, it's synced back over, but it's not stored in your iOS backups. So even though it's on your phone, it's not being backed up in the iOS backup. And that's, again, just to save space. And the point is that, you know, you should have that music already on your computer so you can resync it back to your device. Or if you're using, you know, iTunes in the cloud or if you're using Apple Music, right, you don't need those backups. So Apple doesn't need to back that stuff up. And then all of your images and videos, maybe some of the stuff in the camera roll, but you can even disable that feature. But the stuff that's in the Photos app, that is not backed up. Again, it's the stuff that would be normally synced over via iTunes to your device or accessed through the cloud. So if you're using iCloud Photo Library, it's assumed that, hey, we have all copies of all of this in the cloud. We don't need to put this into the iOS backup. It's also assumed that you are syncing or importing your photos into the Photos app when you connect your Mac, connect your iOS device to your Mac, so they shouldn't have to back those up. So for photos, especially if you are manually syncing through iTunes, you probably want to set it up and make sure that you are, every time you connect, syncing your photos into the Photos application or into a folder on your Mac. And luckily, that's fairly easy to do. What you do is you open up iTunes on your computer, you connect your iPhone, iPad, or iPod to your Mac with the USB cable, and then click on the device icon inside iTunes, and then in the sidebar on the left-hand side of the window, click on Photos. And then check the checkbox that says Sync Photos. Now, if you're using iCloud Photo Library, you might see something that says iCloud Photos is on. If that's the case, then you're not going to be able to select this option because you're not syncing through iTunes. You should be syncing through iCloud Photo Library, right? So they should be going up to your iCloud Photo Library and then back down to your Mac. And remember, you want to set up, if you're using iCloud Photo Library, you want to set up one Mac that is downloading all of the originals and make sure that you're backing up that photo library on that Mac. But if you're not doing that, you want to sync photos directly, check the box that says sync photos, and then you can choose the app or folder that you want to sync those to. Now, by default, it's going to be the Photos app, but you could change it to just a folder, and then all your every time you connected your iPhone to your Mac or your iPad, it would put those images from your device into that folder. So you have those options, and then you can also check the option to include or not include videos. And then you can select a app or folder for the videos as well. And then when you click apply, then each time, each and every time, you know, you that from that point forward, when you connect your device to your Mac, it's going to sync over and save your photos. So you want to make sure you're doing that if you're not sort of syncing them up or saving them any other way. And that's kind of the list of what's not backed up. All that other stuff should normally be backed up. Now, again, when you're doing a manual backup in iTunes, if you want to have it save your health data and your passwords, remember the other thing that you need to do when you are setting up your backup options is make sure you check the checkbox that says use encrypted backups. If you don't use encrypted backups, you can lose things like your health data, which would include things like your step counts and all those sorts of things. So, and all that progress that you have. So very important if you're backing up through iTunes that you do that and make sure you remember to do that. But great piece from Glenn, and certainly something I thought was worthwhile for us to discuss here on the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. I also want to say a thanks to all of my Patreon supporters. If you are a Patreon supporter, make sure you check out the Patreon page because I am starting to post exclusive posts and content there. This week, I gave my first impressions of the HomePod. There's also a video up there that shows a little bit of the startup process of the HomePod. So if you want to see that, you can check that out by visiting the Patreon page. And that is for Patreon supporters. If you'd like to become a Patreon supporter, we only need 18 more people to reach 200 supporters. I'd love to hit that goal before the next MacCast. We're about a third of the way to our first monetary goal. And every pledge is definitely appreciated. You know, even a buck, 25 cents an episode, that goes a long way to helping support the MacCast, and I really appreciate that. I've also been posting stuff in the MacCast Slack channel, so everybody who becomes a Patreon supporter gets access to the MacCast Slack. There's a great community of people building up there. We're helping each other out, we're answering questions, and you can be a part of that by becoming a Patreon supporter. So visit patreon.com/MacCast for all the details, and again, big thanks to everyone who has supported so far. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. You know, the community is what makes this podcast work. So if you have a burning question, you have a topic you'd like to hear me cover on a future episode of the MacCast, you need help with something, or you just have a general comment, you want to make an observation about something Apple or Mac related, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And then finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.